So hello and welcome to the Easy Button, our anniversary show. We've been going for 1 year, and so it's time to reveal our master plan, and this show is about me. It's about me, my reviews, my opinions. This is like a tribute to my ego. You know, I've been doing this show solo for a year or so, and you know, there's no one else in this podcast at all, and I was expecting like a laugh or something, I don't know. Oh no!
Oh wait, you want me to talk?
No, I was just like, I was trying to provoke like a reaction or something. I thought like, it was one of those things where, you know, like the X-Files, that episode of the X-Files, where Mulder wishes that everyone, he had some peace and quiet and everyone disappeared. And I thought for a second, that's what I got, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Oh, I just thought this was all about you. I was going to let you go.
Oh man. Well, happy anniversary. Happy anniversary, my wonderful co-host.
Yeah, I would have bought I wasn't paying attention to the date.
You know what, I'm glad you're back, because I was worried that I'd have no one to talk to apart from myself, and it would have been a whole podcast full of ums and ums.
Oh, so man.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. And I hope you've been enjoying the show for the last year or so. Your hosts, as usual, are James Prendergast and...
Taylor Boone. Hi, everybody.
Cool. To kind of celebrate our 1 year anniversary, I'm not going to say that too many times, or you can, you know, maybe play drinking games the only times we say it.
I am.
I thought, oh, you're drinking already? Okay, fair enough. That's good. I thought we'd like go straight into the news. There's not much on this week, actually, over last week. The only thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was the Dead Island trailer that I saw that we'd both been following in the thread on the forums.
Yes.
And it was quite funny, the kind of emotions it evoked from different people. Some people, they said it was cheap and horrible. Other people said it was a masterstroke of art and stuff. And I just thought it was quite a effective marketing tool. You know, it was quite a good trailer as far as directing goes.
Yeah, I agree. It's I think it's all of the above. I think it is, it is kind of cheap,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're a parent. to use that sort of imagery.
Yes, yeah.
In order to sell something. But I also think, with the caveat that this is for a video game, right? Uh-huh. It was highly effective, and it was highly evocative, at least for me.
The thing that got me was, that was probably the best video game trailer I've ever seen, as in production quality. I mean, it's not necessarily representative of what the game's going to be, but as a trailer, as a way to get people interested, like even the kind of the Mad World, Gears of War, and the the Halo 3 adverts, they weren't as good at getting my attention.
Right. Well, and I think part of it is it kind of came out of nowhere, so you had no context for it other than the name, and you know this game is about zombies.
Mm.
That could mean a lot of things, right? And there's been a lot of video games written about, you know, zombies recently. So you don't have a lot of context, and then it comes through with this, you know, very powerful imagery throughout the trailer, and it really kind of hits you out of left field because it works on a lot of different levels,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
did you see the re-edited trailer that shows it all in sequence?
Yeah.
Did you catch everything in the original trailer? Because I missed out on lots of details.
Yeah. I think because, you know, we're linear time animals, right?
Yeah.
That switching and swapping tends to hide things, and you don't see causality work the way you expect it to, so it does hide some things. And I think the reversed trailer doesn't work as well, right?
Which one, sorry?
The reversed trailer, the trailer where they took it and they cut it into, you know, the ostensibly the correct time.
Oh,
sequence.
No, it doesn't work at all. No, it's not. It doesn't create any kind of tension or anything, does it? It's just the
right. I mean, it's still kind of a horrific story, but
yes, yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't work quite as well as the shifted cuts of time, you know, back and forth. That works a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you do miss a lot of things, but, I mean, I think the thing is that when you watch the original, I don't know if you, you know, at least when I watch the reverse one, the one that's been the re-edited
yes,
one,
yeah.
It's not that I miss them. It's just that when you watch it the way it was originally put together, you're not paying attention to the details, mm-hmm. right? Like when the mother goes and gets the knife, and you know, to be all the stuff the pedants have kind of glommed onto.
Okay.
You don't pay attention. You're really centered in on what the main action is on the screen.
Because things I missed out on, the main two things were, I thought that the guy was knocked back and the girl flew off his back out the window.
Right.
I didn't realize she'd been turned into a zombie.
Oh, yeah.
And that, like, from the first one. And there was also something else as well. I can't remember it now. That doesn't matter. Oh, that's right. And the mother seeing the girl had turned into a zombie.
Yeah.
I thought she was shocked at seeing her being knocked off the father's back. And that watching that forwards, that little moment, was actually more powerful than in the original trailer, because they really captured the kind of the mother's turn of emotion.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd see it when I watched it the first time. I caught that. I mean, I think I was watching the people's faces because it drew me in almost like a movie does, draws you into the people's faces.
Yeah,
and you can see that brief flash, and it is very brief, where it's concern to horror, right?
Yes,
and that's, you know, to me, that's what made it very powerful, was their ability to capture those human emotions so effectively in this trailer.
Speaking of capture, though, do you think it was a lot of mocap? Because some, like the guy's face and some of the movements were very over realistic, as if they'd been directly mapped onto models by, you know, mocap.
Well, possibly. I mean, that seems becoming more of a trend in games these days, where they mocap all the movements of a character in a game. I mean, Uncharted 2, right, was really acted by real actors in mocap suits.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and that's why they got the level of fidelity in the action that they did. That's why, you know, the facial stuff works as well as it does, too, because they mocap their faces.
Hmm.
So I think you're starting to see a lot more of that come into these sorts of story-driven video games.
Okay.
Just another tool in the toolbox, right?
The box, yeah. Well, it's effective, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, no, I just wanted to mention that, because I thought it was poignant. I'm not sure the word was before that.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Stood out from the rest of the week, anyway.
It hit a lot of emotional, you know, chords, at least within me. I mean, it was poignant and sad and horrible and horrific.
And it's kind of what you want from a zombie kind of environment, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it fulfilled its primary goal, which is to get you thinking about the game and excited about the game. I don't know if I'm excited about this particular game, but I'm a lot more interested in it than I was if they just posted up, hey, coming soon, and posted some random, you know, gameplay trailer, right?
Yes, yeah. If it had been just like a kind of, even, I don't think even an ARG would have garnered this much interest.
Right. And I think part of it, like we talked about, is it's very cinematic, and it does approach, you know, the level that some admittedly bad movie trailers reach, right? I mean, it's kind of interesting that we're getting to the point where a video game trailer can approach, you know, the emotional resonance of a movie trailer, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I think that says a lot for the, you know, how far things have come,
and the quality of people working in the industry as well. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
It wasn't so long. I mean, the kind of level of detail that's going on in the trailer was pretty much on par with Final Fantasy: The Spirits Within, and that at the time was like not real time development. That was developed over 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, that was decades and decades of computer time to get that, and. Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly approaching that. There's no doubt about it. Let's say we don't know anything about the game, really.
That's true.
So it could be a horrible, horrible game that has a really awesome trailer, but yeah. I think, you know, that it does move the art forward.
I've played a couple of Techland games, and they made Chrome and Spec Force, and they also made Call of Juarez and the sequel. they're a good developer, really. I mean, they're never AAA.
Right.
They're what I would call AA.
Right.
But they make good games, and they have, I don't think they've ever had any bugs in their games. So, right. Solid games. So, you know, the worst we can expect, I think, I hope, is just a solid game, you know what I mean?
Right.
Which isn't bad.
Well, you know, it probably won't come out on PC, so I probably won't play it, so...
Well, I'd be surprised if they don't, because Techland traditionally are PC only.
Really?
Yeah, oh, really? I mean, Chrome Specforce were, I think, PC only. And it was only when they were Call of Juarez, and I don't think that even came out originally on the consoles. It was first PC, I think. And then, obviously, the sequel was console-focused.
Right. Well, I guess I'm putting myself in a PC ghetto then. Oh, we're not going to get it on the PC. Poor me. I'm so sad.
I'm just sad because the Eastern Europe developers who develop brilliant games aren't releasing the games in proper English language. So or to the Western kind of hemisphere. So things like Jak and Sang the River of Time, it's only available in America. It's not available on Steam and in Impulse. It's not available in the UK or in the rest of Europe.
Well, but
apart from Germany,
it wasn't available on Steam in the United States until a couple of days ago.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, yeah. But it wasn't Impulse, though. It was on Impulse, okay. Like, about 2 weeks ago or something like that.
Oh, okay. Well.
But it's just it boggles the mind. And then there's things like Boiling Point 2, White Gold is called. That's been released, and that's I'm not sure that's in English properly. And then there's things like Precursors. And all these games that I quite like to play that are kind of on the same kind of level of Stalker, you know what I mean? They're interesting. They may not be the best games in the world, but they've got an interesting premise.
Right. Well, that is too bad. I'm sure there's a business deal somewhere that's sitting on somebody's desk or something. I mean,
yeah. I mean, something will happen eventually. I mean, you've got how many... Is it Hudson or someone who brings Japanese like RPGs over to America?
Atlas,
that's the one. So there's got to be someone like that waiting in the wings somewhere.
You'd think, right? You'd think.
Yeah.
I can't see in this day of globalization that people are going to, in digital distribution, that they're going to leave any money on the table by not shipping it for a region.
Well, you say that, but you know, the 3DS is region locked, the new PSP is region locked, so the downloads on the PS3 are region locked.
Well, the region lock is different from making it available within a region, right?
That is true, but not every region is accounted for. Like, you don't have all countries available on PSN or Xbox Live.
Right, but you wouldn't have translations for all languages either. So
no, that's true. That's true.
You know, I mean, I think to me, region locking, while a regrettable thing, speaks more to our screwed up, twisted rights management policy. You know. Balkanized rights management than it does to anything else, right? I mean, I'm sure the developers would rather make one game one time and ship it to everybody.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
But unfortunately, every country has their own idea of what is copyright, right?
Yes,
what is trademark, and those sorts of legal things, and so you have to account for them, and regionalization is a way to do that.
I suppose, yeah.
Because nobody wants to do a translation, right? because it costs extra money to do.
The relative cost of translation is minuscule to developing an actual game, though.
But it's a pain in the butt to design a game or any piece of software with translation in mind.
I wouldn't have any idea of that.
Yeah, I mean, if you start off and you say, we're going to translate this game, you can do things to make it easier to do later. Because usually you write it once in the primary language, and then you have a translation team come in and translate all the assets, text, and make sure there's no unfortunate images and you know, stuff like that, right?
Fair enough. Seeing our anniversary show, let's move on to the games we've been playing around the water cooler. Do you want to go first?
Sure, I'll go first. I don't have a lot, But one game that I've been just head over heels into recently, it's really sucked me in, is this game called Crusader Kings by Paradox. And basically, it's a Paradox deep strategy game set in medieval Europe.
Okay.
So whereas Europa Universalis III, you can start in 1399 and play till 1815, and in Victoria II, you start in 1836 and you end in 1936, uh-huh. and you play any country in the world. Crusader Kings, you start in 1066 with the Norman conquest of England, and you can play till 1459, I believe, or 1453. Okay. And you can play not just as a kingdom, but you can play as a duchy or as a count,
oh, wow.
as a county.
It's quite a big level of detail, though.
It's you know, it's as typical for Paradox, it is deep. It's very
How
deep.
Do they pump out these games?
Well, this is an older game.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's like another one.
This was originally released in like 2004, I believe, and it had an expansion released in 2007. And the interesting part about the game is you don't really play as a country, you play as a dynasty. And you are, as a player, are always the head of the dynasty.
Okay, so when someone dies, you take their place, but they're still within the family kind of thing.
Right, but so you have to worry about... You know, heirs. Because if you run out of heirs,
you're
done.
Yeah,
game's
yeah.
over.
Okay.
And do they have? You have to worry.
They have impotency in the game.
Yes,
they do.
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Absolutely do. you have to worry about marriage, and you know, and they have some sort of digital DNA where it combines the traits from, you know, the father and the mother to make. You know, a child that is based on their characteristics.
Do those stats affect your ability to play the game, do they?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, brilliant.
So if you have, basically you have four main stats. You have martial ability, which is basically related to how you can raise and lead troops and how you fight. You have diplomacy, which is, as you would expect, relates to how you relate to other, you know, political entities.
Uh-huh.
You have... stewardship, which helps you get the most out of the money in your domains. And then you have intrigue, which protects you from assassination and gives you intelligence about external entities, right?
Yeah.
And so you have those things. Then there's some hidden characteristics as well. You have a health, so you can be sickly or be, you know, hale and hearty. And as you get uh-huh. older, your health goes down. And when you hit zero, you're dead.
Okay.
And then you have this fertility stat, which the more fertile you are, the more likely you're going to have a child.
Yeah.
And then you also have these things, you know, so you have these characteristics. Then you have traits, which you get over time. So if you have a child and you send them to the army, they're going to have more martial traits. And when they graduate, if you will, when they come of age, they gain, you know, an ability based on this characteristic. And you can have... You know, like Grand Strategist or Battlefield Hack. It's not a real one, but basically that's what it is. And it affects your primary characteristics. So your characteristics can go up and down based on these traits.
Okay.
So you can have Suspicious, which means your intrigue goes up, but your diplomacy goes down. And you can have Lustful, which means your fertility goes up, but your diplomacy goes down, for instance.
Presumably because you're trying to seduce the ambassador's wife or something.
And that's probably an event that could happen, right? I mean, you know, as you play, there's events that fire all the time that can add traits.
Okay.
So if you fight a battle, you can get, you know, an event that says, you know, you displayed courage, and which will give you, like, the courageous trait, which increases your martial ability.
Okay.
Or coward, right?
Yeah.
You ran.
Yeah.
And your martial trait is reduced. So it's really cool because you know, you're the person that you're playing and all the people in your court and your mother and father and your children and your siblings all have this dynamic change going on as the game goes forward. And so it's very fascinating. It's more personalized, I guess, than something like Europa Universalis 3 where you're playing as a kingdom,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
These are more about the people that make up the kingdom and their interrelationships. I mean, you know, your wife can get pissed at you and... you know, you have to try to get her back or not if you don't want to. And you can assassinate people and you can make claims on other domains and then go fight wars. and you have...
Can you like assassinate your wife, blame it on your neighbor, and then go and invade them?
Well, you can assassinate your wife, absolutely. Who gets blamed kind of depends on a lot of things, right? Your intrigue level, specifically. The more intrigue you have, the less blame you're going to take.
Okay.
Right? The less intrigue you have, the more people are going to find out that you kill family members. And nobody wants to marry into your family then.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It works for Henry VIII.
It did work, but, you know, he could get away with it. He had a lot of prestige. And so, you know, it's just fascinating. It's just sucked me in because it's like,
It sounds a lot like the kind of, not a lot like, but it sounds a bit like the families in Rome, Total War, where you had the attributes, you're kind of trying to keep your retainers and stuff like that, and you're trying to build your family. And then some little punk, snot-nosed punk comes along and decides you're the spoiled brat, and he ruins your whole plans. He's useless.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of that, even more so than Rome Total War, though. I mean, that it's like that on massive steroids. But the other thing you have to worry about is your inheritance laws, right? So it models like six different versions of the inheritance laws that were prevalent at the time.
Okay.
And so you may have set everything up nice, but your doofus, crappy oldest son... he's going to inherit it and run it into the ground because he has no good characteristics. And so you may be tempted to change the inheritance laws so that you can,
give it to, like, your named person.
Right, or you can, and, but, you know, a lot of times that'll backfire because, first of all, it costs a lot to change your inheritance laws. But second of all, you know, you may change it and then two generations down the road, that's not what you want to do, right?
Yes, yeah.
The guy you want to inherit your stuff isn't the right guy. And, you know, and then also, you know, your realms tend to, you build them up over a lifetime and then they tend to break down because you have to account for all of your, you know, all of your children. You got to try to get them all some land. Otherwise, you start to lose prestige because you don't have enough land for all your sons.
All right, okay.
You got to try to marry off your daughters to right. I mean, it's just fat. It's just deep and wide. It's typical Paradox, but it's just great. And there's so much awesome family drama going on that it's just, you know, it's amazing. And then you throw in all the kingdom stuff too, you know, and the popes in there mixing things up. And, you know, you got the Holy Roman Emperor doing stuff. And
do you get required to do things for the Catholic?
Absolutely. Your liege can take money from you, basically.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Crown duty, and then he can also call you to war as well. So you have to decide whether you want to raise an army, which is very expensive, and go fight. And then, you know, the thing is when you raise the army for the king, he gets your troops. So you can't do anything.
All right.
You're just off fighting wherever the king decides to send you.
Oh, man.
So
you can, like, get killed in some stupid combat thing that you don't really want to be in, but you set yourself to be in.
Absolutely, absolutely. Then it models disease, right? So I was playing a game earlier this week. And I had everything set up. I partitioned my lands perfectly for my oldest son to inherit exactly what he needed to inherit. And then he dies of typhus.
Oh,
and all
no.
my plans were just totally, totally ruined. I had to scramble around because my guy was like 75 years old. Trying to redo everything so the second useless son could inherit just what he needed to inherit. It's great. It's fascinating.
It sounds really good, actually. Where did you get this from? Is it on Steam, or is it on Little Games?
No, I got it off of Direct to Drive.
Direct to Drive, okay.
Which is actually, Gamersgate.
Gamersgate, okay.
Which is actually, I found out, is actually Paradox's online. Paradox runs that.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Damn them.
They're somehow involved with all that stuff. So you can buy all of Paradox's games off of Gamersgate.
So it's kind of like Thingamajig with Good Old Games. It's like a studio runs that, or even Valve with Steam.
Yeah, like kind of like that.
But they're kind of separate entities, sort of.
Yeah, this is more of a separate entity. But yeah, there is definitely a relationship between Gamersgate and Paradox.
Okay.
But what got me kind of playing this was, you know, I was playing Europa Universalis 3. Mm-hmm. I'm writing an after-action report for the Gamers with Jobs forums.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And then, in the forums themselves or on the front page?
Yeah, in the forums.
All right, okay.
Yeah, they're not. I'm not nearly good enough.
You're popular, though. You're popular with the masses.
The masses love me. That's what I say. But yeah, so I was playing that, and they also recently announced they're coming out with a Crusader Kings 2 next year. Paradox announced it at the Paradox ComParadox.com a couple weeks ago. And so I started getting very interested in it. You know, a lot of people love this game, and I'm like, well, what's all the hype about?
Okay.
And so I decided to pick it up, and it's really cheap because it's old. And I just started playing. I'm just like, you know what? The hell with Europa Universalis 3, at least for right now. This is so awesome. I'm just going to suck, and it has totally sucked me in.
Brilliant. I love when a game sucks as well.
Yeah, you just start playing, and of course, it's typical Paradox. It's actually worse, you know, the further back you go. They don't have any tutorials or information. There's not a lot of information. So you got to kind of like just jump in and start playing and start to figure stuff out.
Wow.
Read a lot of forum posts and
I suppose it helps
try to get a handle on
it. Sorry, I suppose it helps that you've actually played other Paradox games. So you must have a signature kind of thing.
Yeah, they do have a way, you know, there's a way things work in Paradox games and that kind of transcends all of them. But yeah, you just dive in, and when I first started playing, I'm like, what? You know, what the hell? But once you start kind of getting in, you start figuring out that it's not about your nation necessarily, it's about the family behind it. Mm-hmm. Then you start to see all this interesting, I hate to say emergent, but I'm going to say it, emergent gameplay that happens, you know, based on all these stats and all these interpersonal relationships in the game. It's just a fascinating study.
It does sound really good, actually. I must admit, I do admit that I am always in awe of the fact that this one set of people are able to do it again and again and again. And it's not like something they've made up. This is like, you know, this is actual history they're incorporating into a game world, which is so much more difficult than making your own world.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're not perfect by any means.
Yeah.
But they're pretty darn good. And, you know, the thing that's always fascinating to me is how plausible the games play out. You know, you're going to end up, you know, like my Europa Universalis game, you know, France has become nothing. You know, it's been kind of divided up, and it's like, you know, there's two, France proper is only two provinces. But, you know, the way it occurred was very plausible. And you kind of, you know, if you like history, and I really love history, it's interesting to see how, well, if this decision had gone this way instead of this way,
this could have happened.
This could have happened. Uh-huh. And you know, it's interesting how they're able to do it time and time again with all of these games, the plausibility of it. And that's what's the important part is, you know, if you're playing this, if it comes out and it just, you, first of all, you don't want it to end up exactly historical because that's boring.
It's just like,
you don't,
it's basically playing a story that you have no control over.
Right, but you don't. But you also don't want it to be, you know, so implausible that it doesn't make any sense, right? You don't want the Mayans to take over the world, right? You know, it's hard to imagine how that would happen, but you know, but you do see some very odd things, you know, like, you know, in one game of Universalis 3, you know, the Moors took over Spain, and this was after most of the Reconquista had occurred. That's when the game starts. You know, the Moors took over most of Spain. And so you had this Spanish, you know, this Iberian caliphate there, you know, that seems historically plausible. But you don't see that very often, but you see it every once in a while. If you play these games enough, you start to see odd things happen, but they don't seem out of place because there's a logic to them. Right?
Yes, yeah. Okay.
So, anyway, Crusader Kings, I think, you know, it's hard to get into. The user interface is not the best ever possible, but if you're into history, I mean, I highly, highly recommend it. It's just fascinating, especially if you like medieval history, which I really do. So
does sound really good, actually. Oh, cool.
So and really, that's sucked me into to such a degree that I really haven't played anything else since we did our last podcast.
Wow. Well, Well, I hope that everyone's enjoyed the show. And.
Yeah, happy anniversary! Drake!
Okay, so what have I been playing? I've got quite a few games, actually, because I didn't talk about all the games last time. So, the first game I'm going to talk about is Darksiders. and
okay.
It came out not so long ago, but it's been a while. And I've actually quite liked it. It's been interesting because the combat is kind of evocative of God of War, and it's very physical. Like the feedback to the player is really good. Sometimes you play. I found like God of War and like one with Dante and stuff like that. It was all very wishy washy. You know, you threw your swords out and people died, and that was it. And you did your combos, right. And it never felt like you were. I suppose you were really having a big impact on these enemies. They were just there to be dispatched with some button presses.
With
this game, it's quite like it's very like Zelda. I mean, I know people made that comparison before, and some people disagree with it. They say, you know, it diverges from Zelda at certain points, but it's basically Zelda with a different skin.
Okay.
I mean, even down to like the game mechanics, like the bombs reappearing and the types of enemies you have, and the kind of the secondary weapons like the boomerang and the hookshot, whatever it's called. It's just it's a really good game, and surprisingly, I'm surprised that more games haven't taken Zelda's gameplay and made it in their own world.
Right.
Because there's a reason why Zelda has been so popular and so successful, and why, you know, Nintendo keeps bringing it back. It's because the gameplay, the components of the game work.
Right.
And other companies don't tend to copy so much, and it's not like a bad thing. It's a kind of a homage, but yeah, it's been quite fun actually. The only thing I would say is that the level design isn't quite up to par with what the Zelda games usually are.
Right.
The dungeons. Pardon, sorry?
That's what I've heard as well.
Yeah, it's just. I mean, and that's probably because, you know, I mean, they have the same designers working on Zelda every year, and they kind of iterate on their own things.
Uh-huh.
But some of the temples are a bit like. Not the temple. Some of the dungeons are a bit like the water temple in Ocarina of Time.
Mm-hmm.
Has a bit of a kind of like a stigma about it because people get stuck. But yeah, that's the only kind of downside of it, really. But yeah, I'd recommend the game to anyone, really.
What platform is it on?
I think it's on 360 and PS3.
It's on 360 and PS3.
I don't think it's on PC.
Okay.
Well,
you're a big Zelda fan, and so
I am a big Zelda fan. Yeah.
Right, so you're saying that you're enjoying it, that says a lot to me, right? I mean,
it's a really good game, yeah. I mean, it's nice because the art style is very individual, and like seeing, because what happens is, kind of, I'm going to spoil it a little bit here, but it's just like the first 10 minutes of the game. Basically, the end times has come, and it's the apocalypse, and heaven and hell are fighting on Earth, and you're one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Your war, and you're kind of fighting the demons and also in certain cases the angels to kind of bring balance.
Okay.
And seeing like the kind of decaying buildings and the zombies, it's pretty in its own way. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It has a certain macabre draw to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like seeing, you know, when you see photographs of Chernobyl.
Right.
And the area surrounding Chernobyl.
Yep.
And there's a certain beauty to that kind of decrepit.
Yeah. A stark, desolate beauty.
Yes, yeah, the desolate beauty, yeah. And that's the same kind of thing. They actually managed to capture that quite well in the game, even though it's quite, you know, fantastical in the way it's presented. So it's quite interesting that from that perspective.
Huh.
But yeah, it's all right. Okay, another game I've been playing, actually only today, I got it this morning through the post, is Test Drive Unlimited 2.
Okay.
And I think I actually may have talked about this game back when I did the old podcast with the Lord of Leisure. And I really liked Test Drive Unlimited. There was just the kind of the ability to cruise around the island, to explore the bends and the turns of the natural kind of road layouts. It was based on the real island of, I think it's Hawaii in the first one.
Okay.
And the cars you get, you win races, you get money, you buy better cars, you can change your car colour and stuff like that, and the interiors, you can buy more houses, buy more garages. It's very, I suppose, completionist. And considering I don't drive myself, and I'm not really into cars normally, for some reason, I get into these kind of games, you know, it kind of, something about them that drags me in. I don't know what it is. I don't know if I got some kind of like OCD or something. But I can start going, oh, I've beat this race 7 times. It's the same race, yeah, maybe like 100 meters long, but I beat it 7 times, but I can buy this car at the end of it. And it's kind of, yeah, it's very carrot and carrots
right
kind of gameplay. And it's, so when I heard that they're doing the second one, I bought it straight away without any kind of, you know, it's, I pre-ordered it. I don't pre-order many games anymore. And it's a mixed bag.
Really?
I have to say that. It's a mixed bag, yeah. Because one of the things with the sequel they said they were doing was they were revisiting the handling system. That was a big complaint from lots of people in the first game. It's not any GT5 or Forza 2 or anything.
Right?
It was quite arcadey. And for the bikes, for me, it didn't work at all. Like, you couldn't ride the bikes. It was unusable. But for the cars, it was like, I guess, for me, it was a good system. It worked okay. You know, okay, you didn't have great handling, and there wasn't a great modelling of, like, you know, individual wheels and stuff like that. But, you know, it worked, and it was fun to travel around. But in this game, they basically tried to make it a bit more customizable. So there's 3 different settings you can have. Full assist is one of the kind of settings. The other one is sport, and the other one is hardcore. And you can switch between these two anytime during the game you're playing. And for me, the full assist and sport are pretty much undrivable. Like, it's, I don't know what they've done, but full assist makes the cars feel very floaty.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't even stop you from wheel spinning or from skidding or from at the same time it makes it very hard to power slide, which you're kind of supposed to do if you want to win races and stuff.
Right.
And it makes it very hard to kind of do the whole, you know, break into the corner and accelerate out. I couldn't control cars that way. And at the same time, I went to hardcore after like a while, and I kind of settled on that for the time being, because I seem to be able to, it seems the nearest to the original test drive handling model as there is in the game.
I mean,
but at the same time, there's another tab which has driving sliders.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if you've ever played like Madden or any other kind of American football games. They have these sliders where you can affect like the realisticness of the game. You can affect how fast people sprint and how fast, or how much stamina they have, and that, you know, these kind of things.
Right.
And they're there so people can tweak and make the game as they want. And I was looking through the manual to see, because these, you bring this tab up, and you think, oh, brilliant, I can affect how I do things. And you have everything from the linearity of the braking and the acceleration, which I presume means, right, like, when you draw the trigger from open to closed, you know, from 0 to 100%, you should have, you know, 0 to 100% braking or 0 to 100% acceleration. So you change that from linear to non-linear, you should have maybe an exponential curve or something.
Right.
But it doesn't tell you that in the game.
Right.
And so I went to the manual, and the manual's really thick, really thick. It tells you everything about all the game modes, lots of blurb about the kind of the network modes and the co-op and the multiplayer.
Ah.
Nothing about these things.
Oh.
You want to know what it says? I'm going to open the manual now. You're going to laugh when I find this page. This is what it says about the controls. So options, controls, customized controls for the steering wheel controller. So that's all it says.
That's really,
like, it doesn't even like say like
what is all this stuff mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that to me means it's only, those settings only affect the steering wheel if you have a steering wheel connected to the PS3. And actually, I've been through, and I've been playing for about 6 or 7 hours now, and I don't think they make any difference to the controller.
Really? Not that you can tell.
Well, it doesn't, yeah, if it makes a difference, it's so tiny as to be almost non-existent. And, but obviously the game settings, the full system, the sports and the hardcore, And I can read what it says about them. It says, game settings. Change the following settings. Gearbox, auto or manual. Driving gauge, full assistance, sport, hardcore. Allow online interaction. And that's all it says. So it doesn't tell you how it changes the driving model. It just says, Oh no, there we go. It actually says a bit further down. This uses various driver aids to give it easy driving experience. Hardcore uses no driving aids. This uses a more realistic and just driving experience. And sport provides a balance between the two. And that doesn't tell you anything.
Right. Yeah, what are those driving aids? Well, yeah, it's odd that you would think that you found that hardcore mode gives you the same feel as the first game. Or as near as. Whereas the first game was, you know, I remember when it came out, it was the driving model was kind of was trashed for being very arcadey.
Yeah.
And it's not a, you know, and Test Drive has always been a bit of an arcadey game anyway, yeah. But down through the ages. I mean, it's odd that you'd settle on hardcore as being equivalent to an admittedly pretty arcadey game, and the other controls are even worse. It's weird. It just seems odd to me.
It seems odd to me as well that, you know, that they would spend, because they were hyping the improved control inputs as the answer to all the criticisms of the first game. Even looking in the forum thread, people are really not impressed with the default, and even like reviews and stuff, they're not impressed with the default settings. And it's just so funny that they spent so much time to utterly fail. It's a bit sad, really, if you think about it.
I mean, is this the one that Criterion did?
No, this is done by Eden Games, and they did the first one. No, Criterion, I think they did something else.
No, they're doing another Test Drive, but I can't remember. Need for Speed Hot Pursuit. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm getting my...
No, well, to be fair, they're all pretty similar, these open world.
Need for Speed, yeah, that's the one where they cross over. I'm sorry.
That's fine. And that's one of the games that people in the thread have recommended as an alternative. But I always found the Need for Speed a bit too much, like, what I would consider the kind of unrealistic arcade games.
Right.
Games like Midnight Club Race and stuff like that were...
Yeah.
Or Juiced Two, where they don't really capture what for me racing is about, and the fun of racing isn't fun for me.
Well, my understanding is that the reason why they, you know, EA got Criterion to do this game, I believe it was EA who published it, was because of that, right? Need for Speed franchise had gotten watered down and too unrealistic for even the target that it's trying to get.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say it didn't burn out. Terrible fun.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's probably a better way to put it even, though.
Well, no, it's funny.
So Test Drive. Test Drive was always, in my mind, a lesser...
No, it was a bit like Outrun.
Right, yeah.
You know, and in the kind of the very lightest of the lightest arcadey type of games.
Yeah.
And Unlimited kind of took a step back from that and made it a bit more serious. It was still, the thing that gets me with Test Drive is it's really, I never did this because I'm not that kind of person, but lots of people played it with their friends, just drove around. Like, you know how you have all these people and they have bikes and they have, you know, sports cars, and they go out and they have drives for on the Sunday or something, or Saturday, you know, weekend drives.
Right.
And these people are the audience that they're targeting with this kind of game, because it's like, it's more about cooperative, I mean, kind of competitions as well, but it's more about cooperative kind of experiences than it is about, you know, beating the crap out of your friends. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I liked it, because it wasn't so hardcore when in its implementation. And when I was testing the kind of different driving models and stuff, I noticed that the analog stick for the steering is like zero dead space in the center. So when you move it a little bit, you get your wheels turning. So that leads you to completely oversteer, because as soon as you nudge the stick, you sense a kind of like a fishtail effect, where you're fighting yourself and trying not to overcompensate. It's very difficult when you've got, like, you know, maybe 45, 50 degrees of freedom either side.
Uh-huh.
And I also noticed as well that last 10 degrees of freedom doesn't count. You reach full lock before you get to the edge of the analog stick's motion.
Really?
Yeah. Which is for me, it's the opposite of how things normally work.
Right.
You know, yeah. Normally you're wishing there was less dead space in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting.
It's really funny. But apart from that, I mean, I'm getting used to it. The more I play it, I'm getting used to the kind of, you know, the driving model. It's not unplayable.
Right.
For me, on hardcore, it's playable. I get a lot of spins and I get a lot of fishtails and can be a bit annoying. But,
well, you know, there's your box quote. Not unplayable.
It's not unplayable. Things though, everything else in the game is improved 100%.
Uh-huh.
The graphics are much better. The car damage model is amazing. It's the most realistic car damage model I've ever seen in a game. Like, if you go into the side of another car, you scratch the paintwork.
Really?
If you bang into the side of another car, the doors get dented and they start sticking out from the car.
Really? That's kind of cool. That is very cool.
It is pretty cool. I mean, I'm really impressed with the kind of work they've done on that. Whoever they're working on that has really done a really good job. And quite nicely as well, is that because you can teleport around anywhere you want to go. If you've been somewhere, you can go there straight away, which is nice. You know, you don't have to spend hours driving.
Uh-huh.
But your damage kind of repairs itself as well.
Uh-huh.
Over time. So you're not stuck, you don't have to pay your winnings to repair your car. And you're not stuck with a really ugly car.
Right.
And in this game as well, they've added in off-road, which I haven't got to yet. I haven't tried that much. But, like, your cars get dirty. And, you know, you get, like, you get damaged bumpers. You get... There are some permanent damage bits, but they added a nice bit of realism to the game. Another thing they've added as well, it actually helps, is they've added a way of making money when you're driving around. Hmm. One of the things with the original game I always found was that I would drive, I'd get in the car, I'd go out and drive. I like driving around the island. I'd drive as fast as I could into oncoming traffic and dodge cars, you know. And, you know, okay, I'd, you know, draw the wrath of the police and get taken, you know, for some ridiculous amount of money by the police.
Right.
But what they've done in this game is they've made that into a game mechanic. So they obviously saw that people were doing that.
Uh-huh.
And now when you have near misses, when you do jumps and when you do slides, you get money for that.
Okay.
And it's like a kind of, it's a gambling game.
Right.
So you start off, you do a couple of near misses, you get $100. And you can either collect that there and then, or you can leave it and you can get another level up and you go to $200 and then $350 and then $500. Hmm. And you can keep on, I haven't got any higher than that so far. But if you can keep this long enough, then you can get to some serious money. Unfortunately, like if you make the slightest touch or, you know, with any kind of thing like a tree or another car, you lose everything.
Mm.
So it's quite interesting actually. I mean, it's a way of making you play better,
right?
Which is quite nice because it doesn't mean you always. One of the things with the first game was there was basically one event I would play over and over again because it gave you $10,000. And it took like 30 seconds to do. So it was like to get to like 100 miles per hour in this little short stretch of straight road.
Uh-huh.
While there was traffic there. And that was really easy to do. And do that again and again and again to get more money to kind of, you know, level up and buy more cars and stuff. With this, I don't have to do that because I can just drive around and I can use my natural driving skills to try and buy more money or try and get more money, you know. It kind of makes you less dependent on the kind of the game, the forced game, as it were.
So basically gave you a way to reward you for playing the game, you know, having fun with the game.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Which is always nice when developers figure that out.
Yeah, that is cool. The only downside, they've improved it, but it's a downside, is that in the original game, police were on your ass all the time. I mean, if you hit a car, like even a slight bumper, you get like a little warning symbol top of the screen, badge flashing away. Like even if you weren't near a police car, and then if you did another little crash or whatever within a certain time frame, it'd go to a full badge, and then if you came near a police car, they'd start chasing you. You'd have to try and escape and stuff. And of course, these things added up, and you get to like three badges. I'm not sure if they went higher than that, but that's the highest I ever got to. But then you couldn't escape. It was too many cars and it kind of got too much and you end up with like a $30,000 fine or something or like 20 seconds in the on the step as it was. Because actually if you didn't have enough money to pay the fine, you basically spend 20 seconds in jail or something, or a minute in jail.
That sounds fun. No, it doesn't sound fun.
It's not fun, but it's like, I suppose at least it's a way of punishing you for driving badly. It wasn't great implementation, but it was something original, you know.
Right.
It wasn't just like a slap on the wrist and you're back on the, in the game straight away.
Right.
Kind of thing. But in this one, it's weird. Like, if you can crash as much as you want, but you can't do it around government vehicles, so that's police cars, ambulances, and fire engines, as far as I've seen so far. If you crash into them or around them, then they'll, you know, they'll get a bit of a warning, but they won't come after you. And like, if you run a red light, they'll get a bit more of a warning, you know, stuff like that. But it gradually recedes over time. But it doesn't include things like driving the wrong way down the street.
Really?
No. So you can be you can go headlong into, like, say you've got three lanes or two lanes of traffic on all in one direction. You're going over head to head, and you go past a police car. They'll like come around and get you. And in fact, I haven't managed to get police to chase me yet, because on Ibiza, where I am at the moment, there's not enough traffic where I would conceivably crash so many times in such a short time period around the police car.
Right.
I'm usually going much faster, so I'll be away before they're even, you know, they're done. So it would actually be quite nice if you could toggle it back and forth, you know, switch it on and off. Sometimes it was annoying in the first game. It'd get annoying because you couldn't get away.
Right.
You know, even if you went off road, the timer wouldn't go down.
Right.
It was only if you were on the road and you were being chased. So that was annoying.
Yeah.
But in this game, it's not enough. There is a certain amount of fun to be had being chased and trying and getting away.
Right. Yeah.
And they don't quite bridge the gap in this game, unfortunately.
Well, maybe one of those sliders that they don't explain does it.
Possibly. Maybe there's like another one that says like realistic mode. And my PS3 is bricked, and, and the police come round and pick it up and take it away.
Oh my!
Yeah, but no, I've had some fun playing this afternoon. It's been interesting. Okay, so we'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll have a bit of a reminisce about the last year or so. So welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that little bit of music there, a little bit special thing for you there. Okay, so what we're going to be talking about is just kind of our favourite moments of the last year or so, you know, what we've enjoyed in our first year of podcasting-ness. Podcasting-dom? What's the word for that, Taylor?
Podcasting-ness?
Yeah.
Casting pods?
Casting pods.
Casting pods for a year?
Yeah. So, like, this is, like, literally anything. It doesn't have to be it has to be gaming related or podcast related. But it can be anything from, you know, favorite moments in the game, or it can be, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. So I don't know if you want to...
There's a trend that really came out strong in 2010 I want to talk about, and it's the resurgence of the strategy gaming genre as a viable genre.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, prior to this past year, as a hardcore strategy gamer, pickings were pretty slim for new ideas on the strategy front. And for some reason, 2010 really, it was kind of a bellwether year especially compared to the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, for strategy games.
And you've also got like outliers like Solium, Infernum, and you know, things that are kind of on the edge of the strategy.
Well, Solium and Infernum, I would absolutely say, is a strategy game, right? I mean, it's just more of a, you know, it's an indie game. You know, it's a one guy developed thing. I don't know when that came out. Did that come out in 2010?
There's also Neptune's Pride. That's by the same guy as well.
Nah, Neptune's Pride is not. It's by a different company. Yeah. Solium Infernum is by this, like I said, it's a one-man show. It's got named Vic Davis, and he put out a game. Yeah, it was released right at the end of 2009.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, we can toss that in because it's, you know, end of the year. But he put out another game called Armageddon Empires.
That's the, yes, yeah, I know that one.
You know, and, you know, his claim, his kind of shtick, if you will, his design, the way he designs games is they're sort of like collectible card games. Well, they're sort of like card games where you get cards and you play cards and they have actions on the world. And you draw cards and that's how you draw the action. But he likes, you know, his maps are very stylized and all his art is very stylized for whatever milieu he's in, his game is in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you could just kind of put that in with the releases of 2010. But if you look down for strategy releases for 2010, we got Supreme Commander 2, which, you know, was a follow-on to a much-loved, you know, it was a sequel to a much-loved game.
Did people like the first game? Yeah, because I couldn't get into it at all.
People did like it. I couldn't get into it either, but a lot of people really did.
Okay.
You know, there's something about Supreme Commander, it's all about, in my mind, it's all about spectacle, right?
Yes.
Huge battles and lots of explosions and robots. And
there is something cool about, cause it, for me, it was just basically a kind of Zerg wave generator. You basically managed to make a complete factory that pumped out enough minions to overrun whatever you were pumping them out to send off to.
Right, right.
That was how it just kind of shook down to me, and that isn't interesting for my kind of playstyle.
Right. Well, it kind of harkens back to an older real-time strategy playstyle, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Total Annihilation. The same people did Supreme Commander, and I think Supreme Commander 2 did Total Annihilation.
Yeah, I would say the first one was a superior game.
Yeah, I would not disagree. But
the AI is probably worse, but yeah.
Supreme Commander is a reasonably big deal in strategy circles. You know, and then, you know, you have games like you mentioned, Neptune's Pride, which is a very interesting, I want to say, experiment into
Social gaming is more,
you know, long time social gaming. I mean, this is a game where it's a Space 4X game that takes weeks to complete because it really does play out in real time.
Yes, yeah.
You know, fleets can take, you know, days to get days in real time to get to their targets. And so that was an interesting experiment. You know, we have a game like StarCraft II.
Oh, yeah.
One of the biggest games of the year was a strategy game. Kind of speaks to the genre's, you know, revitalization and vitality.
Yes, yeah.
The fact that you can have something like that. Civilization V, even though it turned out to not be what everybody wanted it to be, it still,
it had new ideas. It wasn't just the same old stick.
I think it's going to go down in history as an important civilization game because a lot of the mainstream press really liked it.
Oh, really?
A lot of the strategy gamers did not like it, but a lot of the mainstream people who, you know, normally follow the Call of Duties of the world really had a lot of good things to say about Civilization V, which is probably one of the reasons why I didn't like it. A lot of, you know, strategy people did not like it. Yeah, you know, simplified things a little too much, and it was a very pretty game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're a pretty game, the mainstream media will pay attention to you.
That's true.
you know, had a game like Elemental come out, and even though it ultimately was flawed, was still a pretty big.
And even the developments within that kind of space are pretty amazing. You know, them hiring a modder, Fall from Earth, or Fall from Heaven's modder.
Yeah.
They've hired to kind of manage the patches and the gameplay evolution of that game, and they've brought in other people as well. And it's interesting to see these kind of things normally only happen for like first person shooters,
right?
Or, you know what I mean? You don't hear about them so much,
right? Well, you know, they got the lead designer for Civilization V.
That was the other guy. That was the other
guy. John Schaefer, which is
a big coup.
that's kind of a big deal, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And I think it speaks, you know, volumes about Stardock's commitment to making this game a platform going forward. I mean, I don't know that they're going to, I don't know that Elemental, the original game as it came, you know, as it was originally released, will ever become a great game.
No.
I think it is interesting that they're, you know, at least it seems like they're taking this as kind of a platform going forward. They're going to release a new, you know, they're going to release a new standalone expansion, I believe, that supposedly has a lot more story-driven elements in it, but it's going to be based on the Elemental technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's all there to be exploited, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, that, it was very ambitious, but they kind of, it's like, kind of like Spellforce in a certain way. You know, it's there to be developed on.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, and one other game I want to kind of call out, which I think is an intriguing trend in strategy games. This game was released this year called War in the East.
Okay.
And basically, it's a hardcore war game about, you know, the conflict between the Germans and Russians in World War II. And it's vast and huge, and you can control, you know, every, I think it goes down to the regiment level, and, you know, turns take hours to plan and execute. And
Wow, okay. And
it's a very hardcore game, but the interesting thing about it is the first kind of high-profile game, or one of the first high-profile games, that charged a premium price for this sort of game. I believe when it came out, it was $80.
Whoa, what?
Yeah.
How many people developed this game?
It's a small development shop, but this is like the second or third iteration of this game. They don't really have sequels. They kind of go back and rebuild the engine from scratch, but they use the same databases over and over and over again. You need to hire artists, but they don't need to hire data guys to do all the research.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that, you know, because war games in particular, and strategy games to maybe some lesser extent, have become such a niche that in order to get, you know, recoup the investment of developing one of these, you know, a war game, you know, they realize that it's not going to be a big seller. They're not going to sell millions of copies.
But they can charge more.
And I think what it speaks to is, you know, kind of elasticity in the marketplace that you start to get. I haven't bought it yet, but I have thought about it. I'll pay $80 for a really good war game.
Yeah.
You know, I'd pay more for a game that's targeted directly at what I like.
I mean, yeah, I would probably pay quite a lot for Day of the Tentacle 2.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Somebody came out and said, we're going to make Day of the Tentacle, but it's going to cost $75 because we don't think we're going to sell a lot of it. There's a lot of people who would buy that. I'd be one of them. And so I think, you know, as we see prices pooling toward the bottom, right, $10, $5, you know, games, and you have all these sales all the time, right,
yes,
where you can buy, I mean, you could buy Civ 4 this weekend on Steam for $5.
Really?
All the expansions. Yeah. And that's
happened already.
That's a hell of a deal, right? $5 for four?
An awful lot of gameplay.
You know, and as you see kind of these sales, you kind of have the, you know, things pooling at the bottom of the price points. It's interesting to see that there's room at the top as well, that, you know, people will, and evidently they sold quite a number of copies of this game at this higher price point.
It makes sense, though. I mean, how many people buy those stupid collector's editions of, like, Call of Duty and Halo 3?
Right.
And all you get, like, plastic helmets. You can't wear.
Right. And people will buy those because they're fans and they want to, you know, they want to get
the experience.
Content, right?
They want
the experience. Yeah. And so, it's to me, you know, this trend of, you know, specialization in the gaming, you know, space, if you will, is a very interesting trend, and I kind of hope it continues because I'd like to see more strategy games developed.
Yeah. Or even like a resurgence of different types of point and click games as well, like puzzle games.
Yeah.
Because they've really fallen by the wayside, and only really Telltale is keeping them alive, really. But they have a very specific way of doing them, which isn't necessarily my favorite way of experiencing those games.
Yeah, if you don't like the Telltale way, then you're. There's not a lot out for you.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting because that you know people are experimenting with these pricing models because they're saying, hey, this game's going to sell 10,000 copies. It costs a lot of money to make because it's you know it's there's a lot of user interface pieces.
Yeah,
you know need a lot of art. You know if we sell it for $60 or $50 or $40 traditional PC price points, we're not going to make our money back, and we can't afford to make games. But we know that people who are interested in this are going to be interested enough to pay extra money for it, so we can continue to fund development. And I think that's a good thing. You know, that provides some diversity within the gamer space that lets us all get experiences that we want to get.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, like I say, it's very interesting, but I'm very heartened by
the success, you know, I suppose.
Well, the success of strategy games in general this year, you know, how many relatively high-profile games came out. You know, we're starting to...
Were you worried you weren't going to run into play?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, TF2's great and all, but, you know, you got to have something else every once in a while.
Some right? bit of meat on its bones.
You know, and, you know, there's only so many old games that you want to go back and revisit before you want a fresh new experience.
That's true.
And so... And, you know, you hear things like Paradox Games, which we've talked about a lot. You know, they announced at their Paradox.com that they've grown, their revenue's grown 300% over the past 3 years in a down economic cycle worldwide.
Yeah,
and
pretty impressive.
And that's very impressive. And so that what that allows them to do is they can put out more of their style of game.
Yeah.
And because they know that they're going to be able to fund that and to be successful at it. And so that's, you know, that's very heartening that you hear things. And, oh, and I forgot Victoria 2. How could I forget Victoria 2 came out last year?
Yes.
You know, kind of a watershed game in the strategy genre. It's a game that, you know, that the company who published it, developed and published it initially said they would never make. And they came
through
fan pressure.
They said they would never make because there was no market for it.
Yeah, that's because nobody would ever, you know, nobody would buy it.
Wow.
And what happened is kind of funny. The president and CEO of the company said, if Victoria 2 makes any money, I will shave my head.
That's brilliant.
He dared the lead designer, and he did. He had to shave his head because it made money.
That's fantastic. Did this post pictures?
I think there's some out on the internet somewhere. That's
brilliant.
But yeah, I mean, it's but yeah, there's a game that the success of the company allowed them to make as a outlier kind of, you know, like
it wasn't even
as a fan service.
They could have lost money on it, and they would have been okay. That's brilliant.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of as a fan service, and it ended up being pretty successful for them. I think one thing we're starting to see as gaming becomes more of a mainstream event more and more people play, you start to see more people migrate away from the what I consider lighter games like Call of Duty or you know, primarily shooters. And some people, not a lot of people, but enough people to start reinvigorate a genre, start to see they want deeper experiences and different types of games. And so I think it speaks well for the, you know, ongoing health of the industry that you start to have this diversity, right? You have a lot of different types of games, a lot of different kinds of development.
Yeah. It makes sense, though, doesn't it, really? I mean, that's where all the genres came from to begin with. You know, you had gamers, and pretty much all games on the very first games were very, very simplistic games. And then from there, you got specialization. So that's where the genres came from. And it wasn't even until really the 90s, that's like, what, 20 or 30 years after gaming started, that we had any other genre apart from strategy.
Well,
because, I mean, you think about it, we didn't have first person shooter until 1992. Or maybe in 1990. Didn't have RTS until... Or the modern RTS until 1995. And we didn't have a third-person shooter until... Or even third-person games. I think Tomb Raider is the first one I can remember. There was Trespasser as well. They were all in the 90s.
Yeah.
And it wasn't...
Yeah.
It's funny. Like, what was before then? And it was all... One screen actions, wasn't it? It's like platformers and stuff. And
you had platformers. You had a lot of strategy games. You had a lot of RPGs. Mm-hmm. It seems like everybody kind of goes back to the same roots of kind of rogue, kind of D&D. Kind of, you know, it seems like a lot of video games end up going back to that's the primary roots is D&D and a bunch of nerds wanting to, you know, put D&D on their computer.
Yeah.
And then some of the nerds want to say, well, I don't really care about the hit points and people. I want to control armies and stuff. And then you've got strategy games. And some people are, I don't really care as much about hit points. I want to go discover stuff. So you end up with Adventure and Adventureland and games like that. And, you know, that, and I think, but I think you're right. In the 90s, we started to see a lot more, you know, as the hardware become more practically used, people could own, you know, better graphical systems, VGA, for instance.
Yeah. And we had the first 3D card as well.
Yeah. First 3D card came, you know, in the, but I think that's when you saw kind of this splitting off of genre, right? You had a bunch of different types of genres spring forth around that. I think now we're going to see a lot more genres, or perhaps what we'll see is they'll become so, you know, there'll be so many genres that it become that, you know, that's like, you know, the limit as it goes to infinity, right? Where there is no genre, right? There's just, it's all just a game.
Just a game, and whoever likes it, and whoever doesn't.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you can pay what you want for it, right?
Yeah. I mean, that would be nice. I mean, it'd be nice if that kind of transitions to that. So we'll see how it goes. But, I mean, there's definitely, that's the thing that's nice. With the bigger markets, all the sub-markets are bigger as well.
Right. Exactly.
Like, even if the market gets bigger only in one, like, because, I mean, arguably, you could say the first-person shooter on the consoles has been the big driver, or one of the big drivers of the increased market, if there is one.
Yeah.
But obviously, those people are going to have different tastes, aren't they? They're going to have other tastes that aren't stated by those games.
Right. Well, and as you play and you get exposed to it, you know, to gaming culture. Yeah, I hate that word, but in general, you start to learn there's more to life than Halo and Call of Duty, right? I mean, there's more stuff to do that's interesting, and that might, you know, as you get older, those games seem to be less satisfying.
Or you're not as good at them anymore.
Or you get not as good at them, or both, in my case. But you kind of gravitate to more, you know, other kinds of things. You tend to want more deep experiences. You want more meat on the bones of a game than just run and gun, shoot guys in the face all the time.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a valid, it's good call.
So anyway, strategy games are back, baby. I'm excited.
I mean, now you've said that, one of the things that I think has been quite interesting the last year or so is community funded games. Kind of, there's been like a big rise last year. I mean, they were muted before, but there's been a big rise in games that have been asking for money before the release.
Right.
I mean, Minecraft's one of them.
Yes.
Even though that may have been 2009. But there are other games that was like Interstellar Marines.
Yeah.
And there's other games. I'm sure there's like some strategy games as well. I can't remember off the top of my head. And they're all asking for money up front. And I think it's great that we have this kind of breadth in the kind of development world. You know, we're not stuck to self-funding or to publisher funding.
Right.
You know, people can help make, may not have the skill or the ability or the desire to make the game you want, but you can help make the game you want in some way.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a nice trend. You know, you find a game that you like, that looks interesting, like, you know, and the developers are taking it in the direction that you want, you know, give them some money and make that happen. It is risky. I mean, there's obviously a lot of risk involved with that.
But luckily, they don't tend to be full price.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that is a great trend. I mean, it does, you know, I think, again, it bodes well for the future that you know, the market's big enough that can support that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so one of my actual favorite moments of the year has been your stories of all the Paradox games. Like, every time you go into one, like on whether it's Heart of Iron 3 or Victoria 2, or even what was the one you were talking for, the King's
Crusader
Conquest?
Kings?
Crusader Kings, yeah. I love that kind of the kind of game where you can make other people want to play it, even though they probably won't enjoy it if they actually went and played it. You know what I mean? That to me is like a magical thing. And it's one of the things why I love doing these podcasts. Because, you know, I can come on here and you'll talk about these things and I think, that's amazing, you know, I want to go and play that game. And then, like, we'll finish the podcast and I'll think about it for a while. I think, actually, I probably wouldn't play that game. I mean, some of them, you know, I may have patience to sit down and go and play and stuff. But it's just, I really love the story, especially my favourite one was of when you were talking about France in Ultimate 3.
Yeah.
And you were kind of building up to beat Germany. That's my favourite one. I really like that story. It was really good.
I should finish that game.
oh man, what have you been doing?
You just realized that.
You're making progress.
I got to a certain point. I'm like, I put it down. Another shiny object caught my eye, and I haven't been back yet. I need to. My plan was starting to crumble, and I think that I got a little discouraged and set it aside. But I need to finish that up and see what happens.
Maybe you need to write up a diary or something and put it on the blog. Like, maybe as well as putting it on Games of Jobs, put it on our blog.
We should. So you know what? Actually, this is a good idea for the podcast.
What's that?
So you play Europa Universalis 3.
Okay.
We'll try it out. I'll try a game that I have never played that you like a lot. and we'll kind of swap story. What do you think about that?
That sounds good. Okay. Good for anything. I mean, I've got one more thing to talk about, actually. It's really stupid, really, but, like, I was playing, when I got my PS3 just before Christmas, GT5 was in the box. I put it in Christmas Day, playing Christmas Carols. I mean, it's very meta. And I know, like, you know, obviously they design, like, different holidays to have different tunes and stuff. But it's just, it's like, you know, in the old games. I don't know, I think certain JRPGs do it, and certain other RPGs do it. You play the game on certain days, you have like a special event happening or a special theme happening.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, and it kind of reflects reality. And that it's just kind of euphoric, really, for me, is, you know, it kind of games and reality colliding in a way which is constructive. You know, I didn't have any radio playing, I didn't have any Christmas decorations up. But my games were saying "Happy Christmas."
Yeah, that's cool. Why don't board games do that? You wonder.
It I don't know. But one of the things was it used to be, you know, Easter eggs, didn't it? You know, right. And gradually Easter eggs were taken out because of legal reasons. You know, you had like hot coffee problems and stuff like that with GTA, and I'm sure lots of Easter eggs get taken out because of those kind of reasons. But yeah, it would be really nice if games had little things hidden away, you know, that added to them. I mean, even now, sometimes you get like the odd news story of like, an old game, and they've found a new secret that was never found before, and then they contact the developer and they went, "Oh, I thought you guys found that years ago." And it's like, you just think, how awesome is that? You know, it's like just programming these little, I guess, presents to gamers, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's all about how easy that everyone can experience the same content. You know, you're not wasting game development time or resources. You know, it's all about maximizing the kind of play time per player kind of thing.
Yeah.
A bit more mechanical and measured.
Well, one thing that when you talked about GTA and playing Christmas Carols on Christmas Day, it made me think about also is why don't more games take into account, you know,
reality
conditions in the real world? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember a game, and I can't remember exactly which game it was. And it might have been one of the golf games, maybe a Tiger Woods version.
The weather.
No, it did the weather.
Yeah.
Where the course was where you were playing.
Yeah,
I think that's fascinating because it gives you kind of a better connection with, you know, what the environment is, right?
I mean,
I think that's just awesome that when games do that, because it gives you a better connection to the real world. It's not just like a movie that's a static thing, right?
That's right. I mean, it's like you go to like a concert or something, It's like the performer winks at you, you know, or he sings to you from right. the stage. I mean, obviously, it doesn't happen to me. It happens to pretty women, you know, pretty girls.
No, it happens to you all the time, I'm sure.
It doesn't happen to me. You know. But, maybe from, you know, not certain types of artists, maybe other ones. But, yeah, you know, it's when you have a connection between the kind of the author and the player. And in lots of games, it doesn't happen so much.
Right.
And I think that weather thing's happened to quite a few games, actually. Well, I say quite a few, I mean like five or so.
Right.
It's not a big but I remember, what was it? There was a game where I remember, like, it was touted as one of the big features. You would have it connected to the internet, and it would download the local weather for your environment, and it would apply it in the game.
Right.
I can't remember what it was, though.
I can't remember what it is either, but that sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's just too bad that they don't, you know, these games, especially, you know, they're trending to always online kind of connectivity for other more nefarious purposes, that, you know, they don't take advantage of that and alter something in the game to reflect, you know, to personalize the experience a little bit for you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It seems like it wouldn't be that hard to do, and it would definitely add, you know, like you say, I remember, not to diverge too much, but I remember, you know, going to a concert back in the early 80s, Blue Oyster Cult, and, you know, me and a buddy were right up by the stage, and, you know, the guitar player for Blue Oyster Cult, you know, tossed me, he looked at me in the eye, I'm convinced of this, and threw me a pick.
Oh, brilliant. Did you catch it?
Yeah, and I caught it.
Oh, and, brilliant.
You know, and my friend... they were playing Roadhouse Blues by the Doors. They were covering a Doors song. And my friend, you know, when part of the song where it says, "I woke up this morning, I got myself a beer." Guy pulls out a beer, chugs it, and he throws it down at my friend. And to that day, me and this friend of mine, that's our favorite concert ever, right? It's not like Blue Oyster Cult. Blue Oyster Cult had a really good show. But if I'd been sitting, you know, on the second level, and you know, it would not have been the same as that little personal touch.
That's right, yeah.
Then we just happen to be, you know, up close to the stage. That adds so much to that experience, right?
Yeah, and it's your concert.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean? And no one else had that experience. But with games, I mean, you don't want to homogenize experience, but you can make more people have those kind of experiences because you can program them in.
Well, to kind of tie it back, you know, I remember on a GameCube, one of my kids was playing Animal Crossing.
Oh, yeah.
And you have one thing that struck my daughter who was playing it. You know, when you start up the game, you enter in your birthday. And when she went to play it on her birthday, it said, "Hey, happy birthday."
Yes, yeah.
It's pretty awesome, right? And and she's even still, you know, she still thinks about that and talks about how cool that is, even though she hasn't played Animal Crossing in God, you know, years and years.
Yeah, it's an old
that's
game.
Still
game
a very that's still a very special
memory.
Experience,
yeah,
and it was so easy for the developers to do, but it added so much to the enjoyment of that game.
It's very powerful as well, you know.
It really is.
I mean, I remember even like City of Heroes, or maybe it was City of Heroes. They sent me an email saying, "Happy birthday, James." You know, are you still playing? You know, stuff like that. And didn't do it anything in game. So you know, imagine if you logged in on your birthday and there was a cake in front of you.
Right.
That you gave you special powers for that day.
Right.
You know, where's that kind of implementation?
That would be so awesome. Now, I guess on the other hand, you know, just like everything else good in this industry, if everybody did it, it would be, you know, it would get run into the ground very fast.
Because
you pop in on your birthday and every damn game is like, "Hey, happy birthday."
You couldn't spend every day... You could do it so every game you played, you it kind of incremented your birthday. Yeah, I was born on the 24th. No, I was born on the 25th. No, I was born on the
25th. Yeah. Yeah, you know, there'd be some gamers who would do that too, right? Every day's my birthday, right? And I guess the thing is the rarity does add a lot to when it does happen. It does call that out.
That's right.
It does make it a special occasion. But yeah, it's too bad that the more games don't do that sort of thing. I mean, even, you know, recognizing holidays, right? I mean, if you're on a holiday, I guess it's hard to do because so many countries have so many weird holidays.
Yeah, even this one.
Christmas is kind of a universal holiday. And, you know, it's kind of, that's kind of a nice little touch. That's kind of a nice little personalization.
Yeah, no, slow is a good thing.
That is a good thing. It would be nice if that became more of a trend, though, that sort of thing.
I think with the kind of trend towards reality enhancements with all these kind of phones and cameras on the DS and well, the 3DS and the DSi and the, you know, all these kind of reality enhancers, possibly that's going to become more of a real trend as right. the years go on. We'll see how it develops.
Well, yeah, that plus the social thing, right?
Yes.
Characteristics get into games. You would think you'd start to see some more of that as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, it may just turn into a big marketing spree, but you never know.
Well, it will, right? I mean, that's just how the world works.
Yeah.
You have a good thing and marketing ruins it every single time.
Okay. So, if any viewers can think of any, you know, poignant or interesting, you know, things over the last year or so, send an email to us at the.easiestbutton@gmail.com, and we'll read them out next show, and we'll discuss them as well. But yeah, so I think we're done here. So it's goodbye from me, and goodbye from Taylor as well. Is it? Is it yeah. Goodbye.
everybody have a good week. Bye.
Well, I wasn't going to say goodbye just yet. I wasn't going to say, you know, end the podcast on that kind of note. I was just going to say, you know, hope you enjoyed the show. And, yeah. Everyone have a good week. David Taylor.
I screwed that up, didn't I?
You stole my lines.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Cool. Okay, come.